begin with an excerpt, and the excerpt comes from a book written by Tim Heald and Mayo Mohs, M-O-H-S. The book is entitled The Man Who Will Be King, His Royal Highness. The Man Who Will Be King, His Royal Highness. The book was actually published in 1975, but what it does is it chronicles the preparation and eventual anticipation of King Charles ascending the throne, which we watched right immediately before the feast this year. And this is from page one. For most people in the Western world, life is a matter of choice as well as chance. It is a cornerstone of our beliefs that we can make of ourselves what we will. But for Charles Philip George, the 21st Prince of Wales, heir to the throne of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, this is no such luxury. He was born a prince, and a prince he will remain until the day he dies, or, as we well know, until he becomes king. He cannot become a brain surgeon or a novelist or a coal miner or a cab driver or take on anonymity. In this case, he is compelled for his life to run a course so that he eventually becomes king. From his day of birth in 1948, Prince Charles, his life has run a course planned by committees and consensus. And even as we see here, and we've watched the events in early September about what took place with the death of his mom, the longest reigning royal, we saw that event, those events associated with the British Empire, we saw that eventually that prince in waiting was called upon in order to become king of the British Empire. With Queen Elizabeth's recent death, that happened to have been on September 8th to be specific, the inevitable took place. The royal scepter, even as established by law, of England was passed to her eldest son, that being Charles. And even as the British Empire happens to mourn and continues to mourn to some extent the loss of their queen, it's really important to consider at this juncture in history how King Charles was prepared for the throne. And so what I'm going to ask that we do today is that we talk some about this. We get some sense of the individual who has become king. Now, we also know that there will all be the pageantry that's associated with him officially becoming king. And those events, if you've been keeping track, all take place in 2023. But for the time being, he's already assumed that role. What I thought we would do is take a few minutes to understand how Charles was readied, prepared for the throne. And then we could draw some comparisons about how God prepares you and me also to be kings and queens in his kingdom. Now, I have to offer a short digression here. If you happen to go to, I'll go show of hands. How many of us had opportunity to go to Jekyll Island for the feast? Can I go show of hands? Oh, my dear, the whole room. Okay, so my dad and I had a conversation even before the feast about potential messages and discussions that we had along these lines. And what was curious to me is I purposely shared no notes because I was writing the same sermon as he did. And so what I was struck by is going back and listening to his message and then listening or looking at mine, because I gave this message once in Beaufort, and finding almost no overlap, which was remarkable to me. There are going to be a couple of places that we're going to cross wires here. In fact, I would probably contend that if you heard his message, this is very complementary to what he offered, but I'm going to go a little bit different angle here and offer some historical background to what he offered. He entitled that message because I actually had to go and find his title, Born to be King, which is amazing, or kings, I think he went plural, which here's the two minds think alike I'm going to trust. I started that direction, but I'm giving you a different title. So here we go. Destined for Royalty. That's my title today. And so what we're going to do is get a little bit of background about, historically, about how King Charles now was prepared for ascension to become the ruler of the British Empire. So let's start here, and I'll start with a section of the book. I will quote extensively from The Man who Will Be King, His Royal Highness. Heald and Mohs do a nice job of chronicling what happened, what was involved with Charles being prepared for the throne. And I'll go first off to a radio interview, a British radio interview, that was quoted or cited in the book on page 185. And it offers the following. Charles speaking. "The first moment I knew I was heir to the throne is one of those most difficult questions to answer," Charles told interviewer Jack DeManio. "It was something that dawns on you in the most ghastly, inexorable sense. I didn't suddenly wake up one day in a pram, a stroller for you Yanks, one day and realize that I was going to be king. Instead, slowly you get the idea that you have a certain duty, a certain responsibility. And I think it's better this way. It's a lot nicer than someone telling you suddenly that you must do this or that because of who you are." And he goes on to talk at length about how this dawning, the fact that he would be king, changed over time. His realization that he would actually be a ruler of, we happen to know now, about 2.5 billion people, took some time for him to come to grips with. Now, the beauty is God talks with you and me the same way, and I would trust that there's a dawning even as we draw closer to him. I'm going to go to a couple of verses right off the bat here. Go with me, if you will, to 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2, and you're going to see some overlap, I believe, here between my dad and my message. 1 Peter 2, by background, no surprise, Peter is the one who's inspired to write, and he's writing about those who happen to be called as first fruits. 1 Peter 2, and we can start reading, if you will, in verse 4. 1 Peter 2, verse 4. And again, here's going to apply not only to those Peter wrote at his time in the letter that was circulated, but to you and me today. It reads this way, coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. So he's speaking of Christ, and then he references those who happen to be reading, "You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a royal priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." And we can keep reading if you want to read what's between here and there. I'm headed to verse 9, which we oftentimes cite around or at the feast. We'll talk about what your inevitable role is within the family of God. Verse 9 reads this way, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." And we can finish reading in verse 10. "Who once were not a people." There was a period of time where you and I were not that individual. We were not called. And we are well aware that it's our dedication, our commitment to God through baptism and laying on of hands, that God seals us. He stamps us with a commission. He makes unquestionably clear, here is your role in the future. When I say that, it's funny even as we kind of process this, there is not a mention of what our jobs are now. When I say that, and I'm not dismissing our role or whatever jobs we have today, whatever career path we followed, but inevitably, God has the expectation that you and I will be royalty. That's how he looks at us. That's how he views you and me. And so as we finish reading in verse 10, it reads here, "Who once were not a people, but are now a people of God." That's how God looks at you in a precious way. "Who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." He looks at you as his loving children. Even as parents, we look at our kids in a certain light. And for those of us who happen to be parents and older, there's a soft spot we have for our kids. There are things when I think about, even with my own son and daughter, in many occasions, even when I pray in the morning, as I pray for family members and I pray for you, I'll oftentimes pray in a very personal way for my son and daughter. And you and I both know, even as we oftentimes talk with moms and dads, I'll share things, even I have the blessing of having dad and mom still alive, I'll share things with them, and I'm oftentimes reminded as I go to get off the phone of what my mom says to me. even as we'll kind of recap what the conversation was about, if there's been something I've asked specifically, she'll say, "Hey, Phil, I'll pray for you about this." We oftentimes do that. So too do we care for our children. I haven't taken the time even this week to think about how many times I've prayed for Jordan or Jasmine. I would say roughly there was a prayer a day for about the last 6 to 7 days. And I think about how I look at them, and our realization is how much more God cares for us. Because God cares deeply for each of us. He's very cognizant of what we're going through and the direction we're headed. And so even as we see here the inevitability of us becoming royalty, which sometimes we kind of bristle at, it feels funny, God doesn't worry about this. In fact, we'll go to one other place even as we begin this message, Romans 4. We only have to read one verse here, because sometimes we can think to ourselves, well, God's on the fence about this. And what we find in the book of Romans from a number of different instances is God, well, has in mind you taking that role, that royal role. Romans 4, verse 17, about halfway through this verse, it reads this way, "In the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls," here's the key element here, "calls those things which do not exist as though they did." Does God see you as royals in training? Oh, beyond a shadow of a doubt. No question. He thinks about you. He thinks about how to develop you so that even as you take a royal responsibility in the future, whatever that might be, whether it be a priest, whether it be a developmental role in some way where you're providing instruction, whether you are over... We had long, as I was growing up, we long thought much about how would this earth be divided up when everyone's resurrected and mountains are leveled and valleys are raised. How would that work? Inevitably, as God plans a place for you, whether it be on this earth or another, because God can, we're not going to shorthand God here. God can do anything he wants. Will he have you in a royal role? Inevitably, yes. And he's already thought of you in that way. And so even as we see here and we work our way through Scripture, and we're reminded of this over and over, God sees those who have to be called, chosen, and faithful as royalty. Not an earthly government, although we can look at Charles and all the pageantry and the pomp and circumstance, and we can be enthralled by all that's there. One of the things that I was struck by, even when we were in England, and as well in watching the events of Queen Elizabeth's death and her casket being driven through the city streets, I thought, man, the British, they just in spades do pageantry in a way that's just so much further than anyone else you come across. It's just remarkable. And so what we see here and we're reminded of is that is an earthly government. God's preparing you and me for a spiritual government, a godly government. And so what we see here is that you and I, through these verses and many others even that we'll touch upon today, God has called his son to that, and at the same time, he has called you and me to royalty as part of his family. So even with that background, there are some conditions that are then laid out in the book, and I'll just highlight today three conditions that Charles had to meet in order to be king. I'll start with condition one, no surprise. It fits with him simply being birthed, him being born into a family. I'll quote from page 25 of the book. On November 14th, 1948, that happens to just be a day or two from now by timeline, a huge crowd jammed the gates of Buckingham Palace along the road that winds around the Great White Memorial to Queen Victoria. Such a sizable gathering had not been seen at Buckingham Palace, the London headquarters of the royal family, since the wedding of Queen Elizabeth, the heir to the British throne, to a fair, lean prince of Danish ancestry named Philip Mountbatten, barely a year earlier. The book goes on page 25, then to talk about the events surrounding his birth, Charles's birth. and what Philip experienced through all of it. And you may know this. I had to go back and revisit this. There was a formal declaration of Charles' birth, and it went this way, and it's noted just a page later. It was actually delivered by Commander Richard Colville, who happens to be press secretary to the king. He noted the following, and he did so with, again with the pageantry that is the British Empire. The Princess Elizabeth, Duchess of Edinburgh, was safely delivered of a prince at 9:14 p.m. Her Royal Highness and her son are both doing well. And the book then goes on from there to describe Charles as prince, but also inevitably king, and what he needed to do in order to maintain that kingly line. That said, God thinks of us along the same lines. And whereas we might not necessarily be born into a royal family, we know from Scripture that God gives close attention to who we are and where this goes. We go to a couple of verses along these lines. You should still be in Romans 4, yes? Let's go to Romans 5. We'll hit several verses that show up in the book of Romans that, again, remind us that although, whereas Charles was to inherit rulership, so too will you and I. Romans 5, verse 8. Romans 5, verse 8. But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And he goes on there to talk briefly about what that involves. Now, we know that, and we cited this even last week with John 6:44, that it's the Father who calls. God has called you and me to a royal calling. And what we find here, even as you continue to flip pages in the book of Romans, what this royal calling entails. Romans 9, if you will, go over to Romans 9. Again, we'll hit a couple of verses in the book of Romans that just simply remind us that you have been called special in order to be royal. Romans 9, verses 24 to 26. Romans 9, verses 24 to 26. It reads this way, verse 24. Even us whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. So he's making a point here, and we know this even as we go through the book of Romans and other places, that God called not just Jews, not just Israel to this calling, but he called Gentiles too. And we see that in 24. Verse 25, we can keep reading. And he says also in Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people, and her beloved who is not my beloved. And it shall come to pass in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. So what we find here is that, again, God looks at you and me as his sons and daughters. You can go backtrack just a little with me. It may be across the page to Romans 8, and we'll keep reading along these lines. Verse 16 in Romans 8 gives us a distinctive quality that God expects of his people, and that being his Holy Spirit. Romans 8, verse 16, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. So God giving you his Spirit sets you apart, designates you as royalty. Verse 17, we can keep reading. And if children, then heirs. So Charles has spent 70 years thinking about being heir to the throne. Now, I can't speak to how old you are. I can speak to how old I am. You can fill in your age there, whatever it might be. I had a birthday the other day. I finally made 30, and I'm so excited. But the reality is, after, what, 5+ decades, that sense of being heir to a throne is still there for me, and it's still there for you. And we see this here, heirs of God and joint heirs with, even as we heard spoken of in the first message, joint heirs with Christ. The one who gave everything so that you can be royalty. If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. You know, I got curious even playing with the term royalty because I thought, I don't even know what that word means. I had to go find dictionary.com, and it offers, royalty refers to a person of royal rank or lineage, a king or queen, a monarch, one with the status and power of monarchy, one who rules, and inevitably that's in part what we will do. And so what we find is, under condition one, God has established well in advance the condition that he, in order for you to be king or queen, that you have to be a part of that royal lineage. And indeed, that's how God does it. Now, he does it differently. He does it by grafting. We understand that. And that notion of grafting, forgive me, so I'm going to digress momentarily. Last Sunday, Sarah threw out the idea of let's go up to LJ to the orchards. I have no idea if you go up to LJ roughly every fall. It certainly is pretty up there. And we decided to, I won't say scale, but walk up Amicalola Falls slowly. I think that's more appropriate here. But whenever we went up, we went to the Panorama Orchard, if I have this right. Sarah knew the place to stop, and so we stopped off. If you've not been up there, talk about a unique sense of kind of people of Appalachia walking around with apples and fudge and everything that's just decadent that you want to stick your mouth on. But one way or another, we were up there. So here's my curiosity. There's one part of that Panorama Orchard, whenever you're in there, where they give you toothpicks. Obviously, they're not fearful of COVID because they gave us all toothpicks and you could go try different apples. I'm going to ballpark this. 15 different apples that they had in there, roughly, and you could get a peck or half a peck or a bushel. When I say peck, I don't use the word peck that often, but anyway, you could get a peck. But even as you were up there, we were trying all these apples, so then I struck up a conversation with the guy who was behind there, and I think, and I could be corrected here, I think he said that there are 7,000 different apples today. Did you know this? I may have my numbers off, but I was quite impressed by that. Then I got curious as to how they come up with these different apples. How do they crossbreed these? And in general, most of the time, I didn't know this part. In fact, I had to go do some reading, and my mom only reinforced this. Most of it is done through grafting, where they will cut on an apple tree a section, and then they will insert some other type of apple tree into that. And sure enough, those beautiful trees will fuse and grow a different kind of apple. And then, no surprise, the apples from that, we get seeds, you get the idea. I thought this was fascinating, if nothing else, because it reinforced exactly what God does with us. He grafts us in. He grafts us in, and with his Spirit, he starts changing us. And even as we talked about last week, that Spirit changes us so that we're not conformed but transformed by the renewing of our mind. So in this case, does God have for you a plan in mind? Without a question. Conditions are set up whereby you become royalty. Let's go to condition two. To be king, Charles was given a superior education. You can go and read a good section of the book that talks about all the thought that went into this. There were numerous, not only with Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, there were many discussions about where he should go to school, who should be influences on his life, and they offer details about all of this. Heald and Mose, who happen to be the authors, say that Charles was well-educated. He went to Cheam Preparatory School in Headley, a school that happened to be 400 years old. He went to Gordonston, happened to be a boarding school. As I'm writing the message, I'm like, where is this school? They contend that they are the leading character development school in the world, and they claim, their claim to fame is that they put out young people of high moral character. Timbertop, who happened to have been in Australia, I was curious as to why did they send him to Australia? Well, believe it or not, at one point, Prince Philip decided that it was good for Charles to get out of England. And Australia, where happened to be Timbertop was, would give his son clarity. That was the term he used. We'll send him abroad. We'll have him deal with the challenges of being abroad, but also being schooled down there as a young man of 17. And then finally, he wound up at Trinity. And the little did I know, Trinity happens to be a part of the University of Cambridge, and it was there that he happened to study archaeology and anthropology. He earned two master's degrees while he was there. So he was well-educated. Now, the logic of him going to Trinity, there was a nice insertion here that happened to have happened, that was offered about mid-text, where they had a discussion about why was he at Timbertop, and this is, at Trinity, and the logic for that was offered here. In fact, I'll read this section. The deciding factor in choosing Trinity was that its master, Lord Butler, known to generations of English politicians as Rab, as in rabbi, teacher, widely acknowledged as the best prime minister the country had never had, That was why Philip was convinced that Trinity worked best. Lord Butler was a notable liberal conservative with an impressive record as a minister, especially when running the education and the home office. He was wise not only in an academic sense, but also in the ways of the world. I trust that wasn't a bad thing, and the Queen knew and trusted him. Here's why I would offer this, because there were all these discussions about where he should go to school and who should influence him. And even after his schooling took place, they also began to think through what special activities, additional services should he be involved in. We oftentimes know the royal family serves in the military, and so did Charles. He was also involved with the Prince's Trust. He happened to be an acting chief role in that, the Committee for the Environment of Wales, and the United Colleges. And so here's why I would only offer these details, because there was a lot of attention paid to who is educating him. Where would this take him? Would it prepare him to lead billions of people? And I think the same thing should really be referenced about you and me in terms of curriculum. Now, we spent some time last week talking about this. I won't go to those verses that we'd been before, but I will go to a couple. Let's go to three. Matthew 4. We happen to remember in the book of Matthew here happens to be, in some Bibles, the header is the greatest battle that ever took place. And we know this is where Satan sought to tempt Christ. We remember this by background. It's going to lead us to a verse that, again, reminds us of our core curriculum. Matthew 4, verse 1. When Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Now again, think by background. He had prepared himself even by fasting. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. And when the tempter came to him, he said, If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. And he references his textbook. But he answered and said to them, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone. He was a manifestation of that. But by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And even last week, as we talked about John 6:63, that God's word is spirit and life, what God provides you and me is a premier education. It just becomes our responsibility to take the time to spend time with it. Even as we talked last week, and we noted even with Romans 10:17 about hearing it. Maybe you spent some time this week hearing. I spent some time hearing. Whatever it might be in terms of God's law, God's word. Deuteronomy 17, we often take reference here. Deuteronomy 17, in regard to what was expected of royalty in times past. Kings of Israel, you may remember what's here. And again, I tend to be an old schooler. My students oftentimes say, so exactly what do I have to do to get a good grade? And I said, okay, I've got a crazy idea. You need to read. And then after you read, you need to ask yourself, what have I read? Because the valuable part of learning, to make learning a reading in particular, a active versus passive activity, it means that you're thinking through information as you go. And generally, you're not worried about what you already know, but you're looking for what you don't. That's what becomes crucial. So I offered even here some background. When I got to college, and I'll share this story again, I was an okay student going through my high school years. But I guess if you go through four high schools in 4 years, you're always going to be adjusting the classroom. I think I was spending as much time trying to fit in as I was to do well in class. So guess what I did? I got done with college, and the last thing I ever wanted to do was go to school longer. I was like, I just don't want to do this. And even I'm seeing Mr. Gompers here. So for the first several years, I didn't go to college at all. And it wasn't until I was 20, 3 years removed from high school and having saved up for college, that I went to college. And my mindset was very different. Maybe because I knew I had to pay for every dime of that college experience. But in doing so, I thought to myself, I am going to squeeze every ounce out of every teacher I have, out of every book. So what you learn from the process is writing. Reading is incredibly important. My students oftentimes go, I don't really need to read, do I? Yeah, it doesn't hurt. I mean, you're going to get smarter. Is that such a bad thing from reading? And taking notes along the way? It's funny, we've moved to electronic textbooks, so they're many a times they're not, it's difficult for them to take notes unless they have, now we've got notes apps that students use all the time. It used to be the norm for me as a college professor to have someone come in with a book, with a backpack, and as a minimum take out a notebook or a laptop and do things. I've got young people cruising in with a phone, with their electronic textbook on the phone, with my slides on the phone, and an app on the phone for them to take notes. And I watch this take place and go, how is that even possible? Okay, we've moved along technologically. I completely get that. But the reality is still valuable that we read. In fact, I happen to have asked one of my students the other day, how do you read that little thing? And she kind of gave me one of those wink winks, I don't always read. And I said, well, we got a test coming. So I'm going to guess you're going to backtrack a little. But reading and writing is so important. So we're in Deuteronomy 17. Let's just read a couple of things here. Verse 15, and you shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. Remember, Israel was so desirous of a king, and eventually God said, this is not going to go well, but I'm giving you a king. And so we read here, the one that God chooses, one from among your brethren you shall set as a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. So there are these criteria for being a king. Verse 18, also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he may write for himself a copy of the law. What did he have to do? He had to write the first five books. That's the sense we get from what's offered here. Write a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him that he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren. There's a humility that comes from just writing God's word, his law, that he may not turn aside from the commandment of the right or to the left, and that he may prolong, want a longer life, start writing. That's what it says. His days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So sure enough, what God offers here is writing is good for us. The only other verse I'll note here, and I'll, even as we wrap up this point, 2 Peter 3:18, God makes us responsible for growing in grace and knowledge. And here's one of the things we oftentimes talk about whenever we're dealing with, in baptism, the individual's responsibility after baptism. It's not an ending point, you being baptized. It's a starting point where we really start to dig in and learn. Now, what kind of resources do we have? Well, I don't have to tell you. UCG Radio, more sermons than you can ever find on UCG's website. United's Bible Study course, which we've been through. We're up to lesson 12. There are different resources ad nauseum. But I would just ask that you give attention to those and find those outlets that work. Spend time. I mean, I'm like you. There are sometimes when I'm in the radio. That was good. I'm in the car and I'll sing to the radio. And you're probably thinking, oh, I'm so sorry. But the reality is there are many a times when I'm there and I've got a radio on and I'm thinking, I'm not getting anything out of this. And that's where I'll oftentimes pick up a phone and punch UCG Radio and throw it over on the seat beside me and just listen. 10, 15, 20 minutes, depending on the length of trip, will completely change my attitude. And it's there, again, to edify you and me so that we can become royal. Okay, last point. Condition 3. In addition to the idea that Charles was given a good education, the other point that's brought out in the book is that Charles wound up establishing an attitude of service. Now, I don't necessarily know how much you paid attention to the events that took place. The beauty of hearing by background Queen Elizabeth's commitment to her people at 27, it seems pretty staggering even as a young person at 27, her mantra in serving was to be a servant of people. Charles acknowledged this, if you happen to have seen whenever he addressed the British Empire after his mother's death, and in that sit-down desk type environment, and he shared about his mother's desire and passion to serve others. I'm going to quote from page 223 because Charles took on the exact same mantra, the exact same underlying theme, even as he anticipated reigning. It reads this way. It is a personal triumph for Charles that his privileged status is not more widely resented. He is seen to work hard as well as play hard, to be concerned about the nation's problems, but also have a sense of humor and perspective. All this goes a long distance to project him during the years to come. Obvious, his belief in his motto, Ich Dien, I serve, is aimed at preparing so that he can serve his people. He offers this: if people respect you, he said, think you're worthwhile, then they'll want to be associated with you. They want you to help them with their activities, with their ventures. And if you choose to go with them, meet them where they are, you can reasonably hope in order to try and influence them to do that which is good and useful. You know, in this case, we oftentimes think of, even as we've crossed the midterm elections recently, we oftentimes see, as we heard Mr. McCurdy talk about, contentious parties. In fact, I think we were sharing even today, the House is what, at 49-49? The Senate, thank you. 49-49, and even as we see, you know, these other offices filled, we are a nation, kind of a stalemate. That's what it oftentimes feels like. And yet, what God is calling you and me to in terms of being royal is a very different way of looking at things. I'll go to two verses here. Matthew 20. This is going to sound familiar. In fact, I'll go to 3, and I think 3 will take us through the rest of this message. Matthew 20. Remember my background here, his disciples asking about who's number one? Who's number? Pick me. Like Donkey on Shrek. About who's most important here. And remember how he responded here? I'll drop down to verse 24. We'll kind of cut to the essence of this passage. Whenever he was asked by James and John, well, the mother of James and John, who's most important? If we drop down to verse 24, and when he heard the 10, because they were contentious over this. Hey, why didn't I ask that? He says this, and they were moved with indignation. They should have heard Mr. McCurdy's sermon against the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself, and he said, don't think like everyone else around you. You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yes, it shall be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be. And this one almost had to just be shocking. Let him be your servant. Don't think about the corner office in the high-rise downtown. Think about the service that comes in helping people achieve their goals, in helping people on their path, in helping people develop, because that's what he was talking about here. Verse 27, and whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Want a role of prominence? Start in the slave role. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life. How did he show us how this worked? Sacrifice his life for the ransom of many. I'll make mention of James 2, verse 8, that reminds us what this entails. In fact, this is one that I, 20, 30 years ago, when came across, the royal law, we well know, is, do we happen to know, serving others. If we're to be royal, that's what the royal law is in James 2, 8, to be a servant of our brethren. So even as we serve others, we are learning to be royal. That's what God desires of us. Hebrews 11. I may be right. I may have one other place beyond this. We'll wait and see. Oh, I know where the other verse I had. Hebrews 11. You know, Hebrews 11 is a faith chapter, and I, for one, at times will stop reading around verse 13, but I'm going to ask us not only to read 13, but to read beyond it. Because again, it gives us a contrast between what Charles was preparing for and what you and I are preparing for as royalty. Hebrews 11, and by background, you see Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah. Verse 13, memory verse for many of us there. These all died in the faith, this listing of people who will be royal. Not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them. Embrace them and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on earth. So even as they followed God, they recognized this was not their place of rulership. Verse 14, for those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. They're looking for a kingdom. Verse 15, and truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So even as God is preparing us to rule as future kings and priests, so too is he preparing that kingdom for us. Even as we've seen Charles in the news be prepared for this role of King Charles and him to ascend the throne officially through that official coronation, which will take place in the interim, he still plays that role. It's important for us to recognize, too, that we need to prepare and have an attitude of service so that we can take that role. You know, I'm reminded of years ago, Mr. Herbert Armstrong used to say, study as if it depends on you, but realize that in studying it depends on God. It's certainly wise advice for any of us if we're preparing to rule. Okay, so we've been through 3 points today. At the back end of the book, page 229, it reads this way. Without question, Charles is already doing much more than any previous Prince of Wales, and he plans to continue adding to his workload. He offers the following in preparation for his role as king. I'm planning to find out all I can about British life, including government, the civil service, business, agriculture, unions, and everything else. Even as he goes on to describe his desire to know his people so that he could rule them well, he gives us a clear sense of what it means to be ready to take on that mantle of kingly, being a king. And certainly, even as we've seen the conditions that he's endured over his lifetime, 70 years, we recognize that he was about as well prepared as you're going to be for king. Now, will his rulership be perfect? I wouldn't offer that it will. He's still human. But the reality is you and I are going to be spirit. We won't be human by that time, even as we take on the royal responsibility of ruling. We'll go to one final verse, Revelation 5. Revelation 5, verse 10, even as we end here, because this is our destiny. Revelation 5, verse 10. It reads this way. We could back up. In fact, I'll read 9 because only as a read-up. And they sang a new song saying, you're worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, this being Christ, and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. And here's where you fit, verse 10, and have made us kings and priests to our God. And here's your job, and we shall reign on the earth. So what we find through all of these events in regard to Charles is that you have a destiny. You may be, you fill in the blank now, whatever it might be. But ultimately, you will be a king or a queen. You will be royalty. Let's make sure that we prepare for that day, that we indeed are prepared to take on that more royal mantle.